he asked thickly, through the cold wadge of tissue. "Twigged 5 minutes after you left. The three last digits on that number you showed me on those supposed texts from Matthew were the same as one of the burner phone numbers. Went after you, but you were already gone. Leybourne sent panda cars out, and I've been calling you non-stop ever since. Why didn't you pick up?" "My phone was on silent in my bag. Now it's in the canal." She craved a stiff drink. Maybe, she thought vaguely, there really was a bar somewhere nearby. But of course, she wouldn't be allowed to go to a bar. She was facing hours back at New Scotland Yard. They would need a long statement. She would have to relive the last hour in detail. She felt exhausted. "How did you know I was here?" "Called Izzy, and asked if Raphael knew anyone in the vicinity of that fake address he was trying to get you to. She told me he'd had some posh druggy girlfriend who owned a barge. He was running out of places to go. The police have been watching his flat for the last 2 days."
"And you knew the gun was empty?"
"I hoped it was empty," he corrected her. "For all I knew, he'd checked it and reloaded."
He groped in his pocket. His fingers shook slightly as he lit a cigarette. He inhaled, then said,
"You did bloody well to keep him talking that long, Robin. But next time you get a call from an unknown number, you bloody well call it back and check who's on the other end. And don't you ever, ever tell a suspect anything about your personal life again."
"Would it be okay if I have 2 minutes?" she asked, pressing the cold kitchen roll against her swollen and bleeding lip. "To enjoy not being dead before you start."
Strike blew out a jet of smoke. "Yeah, fair enough," he said, and pulled her clumsily into a one-armed hug.
1 month later. Epilogue. "Your past is dead, Rebecca. It has no longer any hold on you, has nothing to do with you, as you are now." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The Paralympics had been and gone, and September was doing its best to wash away the memory of the long, union-jacked summer days when London had basked for weeks in the world's attention. Rain was pattering against the Cheyne Walk Brasserie's high windows, competing with Serge Gainsbourg as he crooned Black Trombone from hidden speakers. Strike and Robin, who had arrived together, had only just sat down when Izzy, who had chosen the restaurant for its proximity to her flat, arrived in a slightly dishevelled flapping of Burberry trench coat and sodden umbrella, the latter taking some time to collapse at the door. Strike had only spoken to their client once since the case had been solved, and then briefly, because Izzy had been too shocked and distressed to say much. They were meeting today at Strike's request, because there was one last piece of unfinished business in the chisel case. Izzy had told Strike by phone, when they arranged lunch, that she had not been out much since Raphael's arrest.
"I can't face people, it's all so dreadful." "How are you?" she said anxiously, as Strike manoeuvred himself out from behind the white cloth table to accept a damp embrace. "And, oh, poor Robin, I'm so sorry," she added, hurrying around the other side of the table to hug Robin, before saying distractedly, "Oh, yes, please, thank you," to the unsmiling waitress, who took a wet raincoat and umbrella. Sitting down, Izzy said, "I promised myself I wouldn't cry," then grabbed a napkin from the table and pressed it firmly to her tear ducts. "Sorry. Keep doing this. Trying not to be embarrassing." She cleared her throat and straightened her back. "It's just been such a shock," she whispered.
"Of course it has," said Robin, and Izzy gave her a watery smile. "C'est le temps de la ma vie," sang Gainsbourg. "Plus personne ne m'étonne."
"You found this place okay, then?" Izzy said, scrabbling to find conventional conversational ground. "Quite pretty, isn't it?" she said,
inviting them to admire the Provençal restaurant, which Stryker had thought, as he entered, had a feeling of Izzy's flat about it, translated into French. Here was the same conservative mix of traditional and modern. Black-and-white photographs hung on stark white walls, chairs and benches covered in scarlet and turquoise leather, and old-fashioned bronze and glass chandeliers with rose-coloured lampshades. The waitress returned with menus and offered to take their drink order.
"Should we wait?"
Izzy asked, gesturing at the empty seat.
"He's running late," said Strike, who was craving beer. "Might as well order drinks."
After all, there was nothing more to find out. Today was about explanations. An awkward silence fell again as the waitress walked away.
"Oh, gosh, I don't know whether you've heard," Izzy said suddenly to Strike, with an air of being relieved to have found what to her was standard gossip. "Charlie's been admitted to hospital."
"Really?" he said,
with no sign of particular interest.
"Yeah, bed rest. She had something. Leak of amniotic fluid, I think. Anyway, they want her under observation."
Strike nodded, expressionless. Ashamed of herself for wishing to know more, Robin kept quiet. The drinks arrived. Izzy, who seemed too keyed up to have noticed Strike's unenthusiastic response to what was, for her, a safe subject of mutual interest, said,
"I heard Jago hit the roof when he saw that story about the two of you in the press. Probably delighted to have her where he can keep an eye."
But Izzy caught something in Strike's expression that made her desist. She took a slug of wine, checked to see whether anyone at the few occupied tables was listening, and said,
"I suppose the police are keeping you informed. You know Kinvara's admitted everything."
"Yeah," said Strike. "We heard."
Izzy shook her head, her eyes filling with tears again.
"It's been so awful. One's friends don't know what to say. I still can't believe it. It's just so incredible. Raff, I wanted to go and see him, you know. I really needed to see him, but he refused. He won't see anyone."
She gulped more wine.
"He must have gone mad or something. He must be ill, mustn't he, to have done it. Must be mentally ill."
Robin remembered the dark barge, where Raphael had spoken in holy accents of the life he wanted, of the villa in Capri, the bachelor pad in London, and the new car, once the ban imposed for running over a young mother had been lifted. She thought how meticulously he had planned his father's death, the errors made only because of the haste with which the murder was to be enacted. She pictured his expression over the gun as he had asked her why women thought there was any difference between them. The mother whom he called a whore, the stepmother he had seduced, Robin, who he was about to kill, so that he didn't have to enter hell alone. Was he ill in any sense that would put him in a psychiatric institution rather than the prison that so terrified him? Or had his dream of patricide been spawned in the shadowy wasteland between sickness and irreducible malevolence?
"He had an awful childhood,"
Izzy was saying, and then, though neither Strike nor Robin had responded,
"He did, you know, he really did. I don't want to speak ill of Papa, but Freddy was everything. Papa wasn't kind to Raff and the Orca, I mean Ornella, his mother. Well, Talks always says she's more like a high-class hooker than anything else. When Raff wasn't at boarding school, she dragged him around with her, always chasing some new man."
"There are worse childhoods," said Strike.
Robin, who had been thinking that Raphael's life with his mother sounded not unlike the little she knew about Strike's early years, was nevertheless surprised to hear him express this view so bluntly.
"Plenty of people go through worse than having a party girl for a mother," he said, "and they don't end up committing murder. Look at Billy Knight. No mother at all for most of his life. Violent, alcoholic father, beaten and neglected, ends up with serious mental illness, and he's never hurt anyone. He came to my office in the throes of psychosis, trying to get justice for someone else."
"Yes," said Izzy hastily. "Yes, that's true, of course."
But Robin had the impression that even now, Izzy could not equate the pain of Raphael and Billy. The former's suffering would always evoke more pity in her than the latter's, because a chisel was innately different to the kind of motherless boy whose beatings were hidden in the woods, where estate workers lived, according to the laws of their kind.
"And here he is," said Strike.
Billy Knight had just entered the restaurant, raindrops glittering on his shorn hair. Though still underweight, his face was fuller, his person and clothes cleaner. He had been released from hospital only a week previously, and was currently living in Jimmy's flat on Charlemont Road.
"Hello," he said to Strike. "Sorry I'm late. Tube took longer than I thought."
"No problem," said the two women at the same time.
"You're Izzy,"
said Billy, sitting down beside her.
"Haven't seen you in a long time."
"No," said Izzy, a little overheartily. "It's been quite a while, hasn't it?"
Robin held out a hand across the table.
"Hi, Billy, I'm Robin."
"Hello,"
he said again, shaking it.
"Would you like some wine, Billy?"
offered Izzy.
"Or beer?"
"Can't drink on me meds,"
he told her.
No, of course not,"
said Izzy, flustered.
Well, have some water, and there's your menu. We haven't ordered yet."
Once the waitress had been and gone, Strike addressed Billy. "I made you a promise when I visited you in hospital," he said. "I told you I'd find out what happened to the child you saw strangled."
"Yeah,"
said Billy apprehensively. It was in the hopes of hearing the answer to the 20-year-old mystery that he had travelled from East Ham to Chelsea in the rain.
"You said on the phone that you worked it out."
"Yes," said Strike. "But I want you to hear it from someone who knew, who was there at the time, so you get the full story."
"You?"
Billy said, turning to Izzy.
"You were there? Up at the horse?"
"No, no,"
said Izzy hastily.
"It happened during the school holidays."
She took a fortifying gulp of wine, set down her glass, drew a deep breath and said,
"Fizz and I were both staying with school friends. I heard what happened afterwards. What happened was, Freddy was home from university, and he'd brought a few friends back with him. Papa left them in the house because he had some old regimental dinner to attend in London. Freddy could be... The truth is, he was awfully naughty sometimes. He brought up a lot of good wine from the cellar, and they all got sloshed, and then one of the girls said she wanted to try the truth of that story about the white horse.
You know the one," she said to Billy, the Uffington local. "If you turn three times in the eye and make a wish..."
"Yeah,"
said Billy with a nod. His haunted eyes were huge.
"So they all left the house in the dark, but being Freddy, he was naughty. They made a detour through the woods to your house, Stedder Cottage, because Freddy wanted to buy some, marijuana, was it, your brother grew?"
"Yeah,"
said Billy again.
"Freddy wanted to get some so they could smoke it up at the horse while the girls were making wishes. Of course, they shouldn't have been driving. They were already drunk. Well, when they got to your house, your father wasn't there. He was in the barn,"
said Billy suddenly,
"finishing a set of, you know..."
The memory seemed to have forced its way to the front of his mind, triggered by her recital. Strike saw Billy's left hand holding tightly to his right, to prevent the recurrence of the tick that seemed for Billy to have something of the significance of warding off evil. Rain continued to lash the restaurant windows, and Serge Gainsbourg sang, "Oh, je voudrais tant que tu te souviennes."
"So," said Izzy, taking another deep breath, "the way I heard it from one of the girls who was there, I don't want to say who," she added, a little defensively to Strike and Robin, "it's a long time ago, and she was traumatized by the whole thing. Well, Freddy and his friends, clattering into the cottage, woke you up, Billy. There was quite a crowd of them in there, and Jimmy rolled them a joint before they set off. Anyway," Izzy swallowed, "you were hungry, and Jimmy, or maybe," she winced, "maybe it was Freddy, I don't know, they thought it would be funny to crumble up some of what they were smoking and put it in your yogurt."
Robin imagined Freddy's friends, some of them perhaps enjoying the exotic thrill of sitting in that dark workman's cottage with a local lad who sold drugs, but others, like the girl who had told Izzy the story, uneasy about what was going on, but too young, too scared of their laughing peers to intervene. They had seemed like adults to the 5-year-old Billy, but now Robin knew that they had all been 19 to 21 at most.
"Yeah," said Billy quietly. "I knew they gave me something." "So then, Jimmy wanted to join them, going up the hill. I heard he'd taken a bit of a fancy to one of the girls," said Izzy primly. "But you weren't very well after being fed that yoghurt. He couldn't leave you alone in that state, so he took you with him. You all piled into a couple of Land Rovers, and off you went, to Dragon Hill."
"But, no, this is wrong," said Billy.
The haunted expression had returned to his face.
"Where's the little girl? She was already there. She was with us in the car. I remember them taking her out when we got to the hill. She was crying for her mum."
It wasn't a girl," said Izzy. "That was just Freddy's... Well, it was his idea of humour."
"It was a girl. They called her by a girl's name," said Billy. "I remember."
"Yes," said Izzy miserably.
"Raffaella."
"That's it,"
said Billy loudly, and heads turned across the restaurant.
"That's it,"
Billy repeated in a whisper, his eyes wide.
"Raffaella, that's what they called her. It wasn't a girl, Billy. It was my little...
Izzy pressed the napkin to her eyes again.
"So sorry. It was my little brother, Raphael. Freddy and his friends were supposed to be babysitting him, with my father away from home. Raff was awfully cute when he was little. He'd been woken up by them too, I think, and the girls said they couldn't leave him in the house, they should take him with them. Freddy didn't want to. He wanted to leave Raff there on his own, but the girls promised they'd take care of him. But once they were up there, Freddy was awfully drunk, and he'd had a lot of weed, and Raff wouldn't stop crying, and Freddy got angry. He said he was ruining everything, and then... he throttled him," said Billy, with a panicked expression.
"It was real. He killed..."
"No, no, he didn't," said Izzy, distressed. "Billy, you know he didn't. You must remember Raff. He came to us every summer. He's alive."
"Freddy put his hands round Raphael's neck," said Strike, "and squeezed until he was unconscious. Raphael urinated. He collapsed, but he didn't die."
Billy's left hand was still gripping his right tightly.
"I did see it."
"Yeah, you did," said Strike. "And, all things considered, you were a bloody good witness."
The waitress returned with their meals. Once everyone was served, Strike with his ribeye steak and chips, the two women with their quinoa salads, and Billy with the soup, which was all he seemed to have felt confident ordering, Izzy continued her story.
"Raff told me what had happened when I got back from the holidays. He was so little, so upset. I tried to bring it up with Papa, but he wouldn't listen. He just sort of brushed me off, said Raphael was whiny and always, always complaining. And I looked back," she said to Strike and Robin, her eyes filling with tears again, "and I think about it all, how much hate Raph must have felt after things like that."
"Yeah, Raphael's defense team will probably try and use that kind of thing," said Strike briskly, as he attacked his steak. "But the fact remains, Izzy, that he didn't act on his desire to see your father dead until he found out there was a Stubbs hanging upstairs."
"A disputed Stubbs,"
Izzy corrected Strike, pulling a handkerchief out of her cuff and blowing her nose.
"Henry Drummond thinks it's a copy. The man from Christie's is hopeful, but there's a Stubbs aficionado in the States who's flying over to examine it, and he says it doesn't match the note Stubbs made of the lost painting. But honestly..." She shook her head. "I don't give a damn what that thing's led to, what it's done to our family. It can go in a skip, for all I care. There are more important things,"
said Izzy croakily,
"than money."
Strike had an excuse for making no reply, his mouth being full of steak. But he wondered whether it had occurred to Izzy that the fragile man beside her was living in a tiny two-room flat in East Ham with his brother, and that Billy was, properly speaking, owed money from the sale of the last set of gallows. Perhaps, once the Stubbs was sold, the Chisel family might consider fulfilling that obligation. Billy was eating his soup in an almost trance-like state, his eyes unfocused. Robin thought his deeply contemplative state seemed peaceful, even happy.
"So, I must have got confused, mustn't I?"
Billy asked at last. He spoke now with the confidence of a man who feels firm footing in reality.
"I saw the horse being buried and thought it was a kid. I got mixed up, that's all."
"Well," said Strike, "I think there might be a bit more to it than that. You knew that the man who'd throttled a child was the same one burying the horse in the dell with your father. I suppose Freddy wasn't around much, being so much older than you, so you weren't completely clear who he was. But I think you blocked out a lot about the horse and how it died. You conflated two acts of cruelty, perpetrated by the same person."
"What happened?"
asked Billy, now slightly apprehensive.
"To the horse." "Don't you remember Spotty?"
asked Izzy. Amazed, Billy set down his soup spoon and held his hand horizontally, perhaps 3 feet off the ground.
"That little... yeah. Didn't it graze the croquet lawn?"
"She was an ancient, miniature spotted horse," Izzy explained to Strike and Robin. "She was the last of Tinky's lot. Tinky had awful, kitschy taste, even in horses."
"Nobody noticed, and you know why? Because they're such fucking arrogant snobs."
"But Spotty was awfully sweet," Izzy admitted.
"She'd follow you around like a dog if you were in the garden." "I don't think Freddy meant to do it, but..."
she said hopelessly.
"Oh, I don't know any more. I don't know what he was thinking. He always had a terrible temper. Something had annoyed him. Papa was out. He took Papa's rifle out of the gun cabinet, went up on the roof and started shooting at birds, and then... well, he told me afterwards he hadn't meant to hit Spotty. But he must have been aiming near her, mustn't he, to kill her?"
"He was aiming at her," thought Strike. "You don't put two bullets in an animal's head from that distance without meaning to."
"Then he panicked," said Izzy. "He got Jacko, I mean your father," she told Billy, "to help him bury the body. When Papa came home, Freddy pretended Spotty had collapsed, that he'd called the vet who'd taken her away. But of course, that story didn't stand up for 2 minutes. Papa was furious when he found out the truth. He couldn't abide cruelty to animals." "I was heartbroken when I heard," said Izzy sadly. "I loved Spotty."
"You didn't by any chance put a cross in the ground where she'd been buried, did you, Izzy?"
asked Robin, her fork suspended in mid-air.
"How on earth did you know that?"
asked Izzy, astonished, as tears trickled out of her eyes again, and she reached again for her handkerchief. The downpour continued as Strike and Robin walked away from the brasserie together, along Chelsea Embankment towards Albert Bridge. The slate-grey Thames rolled eternally onwards, its surface barely troubled by the thickening rain that threatened to extinguish Strike's cigarette, and soaked the few tendrils of hair that had escaped the hood of Robin's raincoat.
"Well, that's the upper classes for you," said Strike. "By all means throttle their kids, but don't touch their horses."
"Not entirely fair," Robin reproved him.
"Izzy thinks Raphael was treated appallingly." "Nothing to what he's got coming to him in Dartmoor," said Strike indifferently. "My pit is limited."
"Yes," said Robin. "You made that abundantly clear." Their shoes smacked wetly on the shining pavement.
"CBT still going all right?"
Strike asked, who was limiting the question to once weekly.
"Keeping up your exercises?"
"Diligently," said Robin.
"Don't be flippant, I'm serious."
"So am I," said Robin without heat.
"I'm doing what I've got to do. I haven't had a single panic attack for weeks.
How's your leg?"
"Getting better, doing my stretches, watching my diet."
"You just ate half a potato field and most of a cow."
"That was the last meal I can charge to the chisels," said Strike. "Wanted to make the most of it. What are your plans this afternoon?"
"I need to get that file from Andy. Then I'll ring the guy in Finsbury Park and see whether he'll talk to us. Oh, and Nick and Ilsa said to ask if you want to come for a takeaway curry tonight."
Robin had caved in to the combined insistence of Nick, Ilsa and Strike himself
that going to live in a box room in a house full of strangers was undesirable in the immediate aftermath of being taken hostage at gunpoint. In 3 days' time, she would be moving into a room in a flat in Earl's Court, which she would share with a gay actor friend of Ilse's, whose previous partner had moved out. Her new flatmate's stated requirements were cleanliness, sanity, and tolerance of irregular hours.
"Yeah, great," said Strike. "I'll have to head back to the office first. Barclay reckons he's got dodgy bang to rights this time. Another teenager, going in and out of a hotel together."
"Great," said Robin. "No, I don't mean great, I mean..."
"It is great," said Strike firmly, as the rain splashed over and around them. "Another satisfied client. The bank balance is looking uncharacteristically healthy. Might be able to hike your salary up a bit. Anyway, I'm going up here. See you at Nick and Ilse's later, then."
They parted with a wave, concealing from each other the slight smile that each wore once safely walking away, pleased to know that they would meet again in a few short hours over curry and beer at Nick and Ilse's. But soon, Robin had given over her thoughts to the questions needing answers from a man in Finsbury Park. Head bowed against the rain, she had no attention left to spare for the magnificent mansion past which she was walking, its rain-specked windows facing the great river, its front doors engraved with twin swans. This has been a Hachette audio production of Lethal White, written by Robert Galbraith, read by Robert Glenister. Directed by Garrick Hagan at Strathmore Studios, Clerkenwell, London. Post-production by Joseph Degnan. Lethal White is also available in print and digital formats from Mulholland Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright, J.K. Rowling, 2018. Production copyright, Hachette Audio, 2018. All rights reserved. Rosmersholm epigraphs from the complete works of Henrik Ibsen. Hastings, Delphi Classics e-book 2013, translated by Robert Farquharson. Wherever You Will Go, words and music by Aaron Kamin and Alex Band. Copyright 2001, Alex Band Music, Universal Music Careers, BMG Platinum Songs, Amadeo Music, Universal Music Publishing MGB Limited, BMG Rights Management US LLC, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited. No Woman, No Cry, written by Vincent Ford. Published by 56 Hope Road Music Limited, Primary Wave, Blue Mountain Music, all rights reserved. Hear the word of Lachesis, the daughter of necessity, from the Dialogues of Plato, New York, Scribner, Armstrong & Co., e-book, 1873. Where Have You Been? Words and music by Lukas Gottwald, Jeff Mack, Adam Wiles, Esther Dean, and Henry Russell Walter. Copyright 2012, Kaz Money Publishing, Dat Damn Dean Music, Prescription Songs, Songs of Universal Inc., Oneirology Publishing, TSJ Merlin Licensing BV, Hill & Range, Southwind Muse, SA, Carlin Music Corporation, Cobalt Music Publishing Limited, Universal, MCA Music Limited, EMI Music Publishing Limited, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited. Niggers in Paris, words and music by Reverend W. A. Donaldson, Kanye West, Chauncey Hollis, Sean Carter and Mike Dean. Copyright 2011, Unichapel Music Inc., BMI, EMI Blackwood Music Inc., Songs of Universal Inc., Please Gimme My Publishing Inc., You Can't Teach Bein' the Sh Inc., Carter Boys Music, ACCAP, Papa George Music, BMI, EMI Music Publishing Limited, Universal, MCA Music Limited, all rights on behalf of Papa George Music, Carter Boys Music, and Uni Chapel Music, Inc., administered by Warner, Chapel North America Limited, all rights reserved. used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited, Sony ATV Music Publishing, and Warner Chapel North America Limited. Black Trombone. Words and music by Serge Gainsbourg. Copyright 1962, Melody Nelson Publishing, Warner Chapel Music France, Imogen Music, Warner Chapel Overseas Holdings Limited, used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited and Warner Chapel Overseas Holdings Limited. Le Chanson de Prévert, words and music by Serge Gainsbourg, copyright 1961, Melody Nelson Publishing, Warner Chapel Music France, Imogen Music, Warner Chapel Overseas Holdings Limited, used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited and Warner Chapel Overseas Holdings Limited. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.